mentored by some of the best minds in entrepreneurship in the world, then you're listening to the right podcast, Ditch Digger CEO. We're going to be interviewing CEOs and founders who will be telling their amazing rags-to-riches stories. These entrepreneurs who dominate the industries they serve will be sharing the secrets to their success. We'll be talking to millionaires and billionaires, many who started with nothing. You're going to be mentored with golden nuggets of shared experiences from my guest, whose time is worth thousands and even tens of thousands of dollars per hour. I started in the paving business right out of high school, and with no college education, mentorship has been my education of choice. I started over 25 companies in the last 20 years, have generated over $1.5 billion in revenues. My guarantee is this. If you listen to Ditch Digger CEO and you want to be more successful, you will become more successful. The secrets of my success and for many of the world's greatest business leaders will be revealed. Let Ditch Digger CEO mentor you.
Welcome to Ditch Digger CEO and me. We're excited. Bruce and I are joined, really excited. We've got a man today on that's lived an amazing life. Still as a young guy, is going to make a big difference in the world continually as he uses his leadership skills going forward. But we've done many podcasts here with great entrepreneurs, and we've had a handful of great Americans, and not that great entrepreneurs, in my opinion, are great Americans too, because they are in many cases or most cases. But when we can interview somebody that actually has fought for our country and been a leader in our country, that's exciting as can be. We've had a few great stories, and this will give you another one. And then somebody also that takes that leadership experience further into the business world and the philanthropic world, that's exciting as can be. So that's what we have today. And Brigadier General Jack Hammond, welcome to our show, Ditch Digger CEO. We're happy as heck to have you. Thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
Well, Gary, thank you for giving me an opportunity to meet with you guys and spend some time today.
So you got my nephew, Joey, out of the Chicagoland area. You got my buddy, Chris. I think Chris is in California right now. I'm in Mexico and going through a treatment or a biotech company that I invested in that I saw amazing results on my son's cerebral palsy. I'm going through a treatment of myself and my girlfriend over the next, we have another 2 weeks left, and we've been here for 2 weeks. But it's interesting, Jack, because I didn't find you. Chris found you, and the stuff that you're doing today and what we're doing down here, I'm telling you right now, is going to be a fit for the future for both of us. I'll talk about that a little as you talk about what you're doing. But my life has just been an entrepreneur, and being an entrepreneur, I've realized that the blessings I've had to build things and build businesses in a free country, a country that we're free enterprise, free enterprise system, and freedom allows us to do what we want to do if we have a vision and we have a plan to serve a market, no better place than America to do that. And never could I have done it or anybody do it without the protection of this free country that's given to us by my friends and our American heroes like yourself. So thank you for being on it. And what we're gonna do today is that just all we do is like just share experiences. We want to give young people that want to lead in their lives, whether it's entrepreneurial, it's military, whatever. Leadership is leadership. We want young people tomorrow and today and tomorrow to look at these podcasts and say, wow, I'm getting something out of this. Every single podcast, they've gotten some nuggets of what created the success of that guest on Ditch Digger CEO. There's a book written at the turn of the century called The Laws of Success, Jack. And that book was a great book I read years ago, and it really is a simple thing, right? Look at people that have had some really neat success that you admire, and then figure out by mentorship and share experiences from them, try to figure out what they did, and if you like where they're at and what they've done, then aspire to lead and be like them, or maybe share a couple of their secrets of success in your own life. And so that's the Laws of Success, the great book written years ago. And this is kind of what we are on this podcast. We just want to share the stories of what made, inspired you to be who you are, and let other people, learn from that. And I'm confident that the 70 or so podcasts we've had so far has done a good job of that. So it's a lot of fun. So thanks for being on. If you could start, Jack, with kind of your upbringing, what What gave you the confidence as a kid that you could go on in the military and do the things you did and lead?
I think that's probably one of the best questions, because I think that affects the most people, right? I would tell you that any success I've had in life is number one based on some amazing mentorship that I've had along the way, and whether it's coaches, teachers, relatives that I saw that just did something. You know, I had a bunch of World War II uncles that came back from the war and did a range of things, but there was a common theme of public service in some of that, working with the blind and then working with other groups of people, working with veterans. And as you look at teams, I had a coach growing up that I didn't spend a lot of time on the track team. I ended up joining the team my senior year because I like being part of a winning team. Guy had dropped out of college, volunteered for Vietnam, fought in Khe Sanh, earned a Silver Star and a Bronze Star as a private, came home, became a teacher, and then became the winningest high school track coach in American history.
Wow.
30 years undefeated.
Oh,
but watching
my goodness.
Him instill in people the drive to maximize your potential was something I got to see. And I didn't appreciate it as much until I got a little older, but I watched it and you absorbed like things that just looked right. But as life went on, you know, mediocre student, went to college.
What town was that, Jack?
I grew up in Reading, Mass, up in the North Shore.
Okay.
Small town, 28,000 people. And we didn't have anything special in the water, but undefeated track teams for 30 years straight, which is pretty remarkable.
That's amazing.
But, you know, as I pointed out, and my teachers have validated, a not a very distinguished student, went to college to try and open some doors that I knew you needed that key to unlock some of those doors. Wrestled, played lacrosse in college, joined the Army Guard when I was a sophomore, and went to basic training and then OCS. And so I'm going into my senior year, I was a lieutenant in the Army on reserve status, which each one of those successful completions, like, you know, make it into Division III wrestling and stuff, and then completing basic training while I was in college, completing OCS when I was in college, each one of those kind of opens the door and gives you that reminder that you really can do anything if you put your mind to it. I mean, there's certain things you need advanced skills and training on, but for most things, it's the stick-to-itness and believing you're going to succeed. After a while, it switches to, you know, you're going to succeed. It's just, what are you going to have to do to get there?
Hey, Jack, I think that's a key.
What
week? I was a wrestler also. I wrestled since very young in high school. I didn't go any further, and I actually had some partial wrestling scholarships that I didn't take advantage of because I really wanted to get to work. But either way, what weight class were you?
My freshman year, I was down at 126. I weigh about 200 now. By my senior year, I had blown up my knee enough that I knew I wasn't going to be competitive. I was actually toying with the idea of taking a year and taking a run at the 84 Olympics. But when I hurt my knee and shoulder, I knew I just wasn't competitive. So I bumped up to about 158 my senior
year. All right.
Year.
Yeah. So it's funny. I started at 105 my freshman year of high school, and I certified and stayed at 155 eventually as I, you know, grew as a junior, senior and stuff. But it's a great sport. It's a sport that you know, teaches you both individual leadership and team leadership if you want it, right?
And a great deal of discipline. I mean, at the end of the day, when you lose out there, you lost.
That's right.
You won or you lost. It's no one else's fault. You can't really blame the ref when somebody pins you in 30 seconds. You can try and wipe that off, but when somebody mops the mat with you, that's on you.
Yeah, and it's a sport where you learn fast from lessons of failure, right? I mean, you get beat. Why'd you get beat? What'd you do wrong? What move did you make that allowed them to make the move to beat you, right? And it's a great sport for learning fast and failing fast, right? And I think in life it's the same thing. You know, learn to fail fast and learn to fail. Learn that you're gonna fail, but when you fail, fail fast. Learn and don't do the same thing again, right?
That's exactly it.
Yeah. All right. So wrestling and then you went into college. Mister, what was the college you went to?
UMass Boston.
Yeah.
you know, I grew up in around Boston, and I enjoyed living there, and just enjoyed my time in Boston in the late 70s and early 80s, and was able to wrestle. I walked on and played lacrosse my senior year just because it seemed like a great sport, and I figured out how to do that a little bit and had more fun in that one season of lacrosse than I did in any other sport I played. Wish I'd started a hell of a lot sooner. After I graduated, I spent the summer in 84 out in LA with some friends at UCLA watching the Olympics, and then I went on active duty that fall, and stayed on active duty until 2012. And when I joined, my plan was to join for six, you had to join for 6 years, four active, two in reserve, ready reserve. But once I get into it, I enjoy the lifestyle, enjoyed what we were doing and the people. And I said, I'll stay as long as I'm having fun. And, you know, every now and then, you get dry spots, but.
So 28 years.
28 years of active, about 31 total.
Wow. And tell us about that, kind of where you started where were you stationed give us kind of the 5 or 10 minute story of that, kind of where you started, where you ended, and some of the highest points and maybe a couple of lowest points in that time.
Sure. After I graduated college in the Army, when you're a lieutenant, you go to your basic course, and I initially was looking at military intelligence. I was thinking down the road of something like the CIA. And because I got a degree in criminal justice, they branched me military police. And so my career began at Fort McClellan, Alabama, doing the officer basic course. I was doing 6 months, and I was planning on then going to law school. I had applied for law school. While I was there, my UMass had screwed up my paperwork, and I got a nice note from Suffolk that they were going to reconsider me in a year. And so I had to figure out what I was going to do during that year. And I made the decision to go on active duty and never regretted that. It was probably the best thing. I probably would have made a lousy lawyer. As we know, the world's got plenty of them, so they didn't need one more. And I think I was able to tip the scale in the right direction on not going there. I was initially stationed out on Cape Cod, which was kind of cool. There's a joint base out there called Cape Cod, Joint Base Cape Cod. It used to be Camp Edwards and Otis Air Force Base. Great place to be as a young officer. I had really two choices. An unnamed place in Korea, which they wouldn't tell me if it was a DMZ or Seoul or with a division. And I figured if they weren't telling me, it was going to be a pretty crappy assignment, or out on Cape Cod. And so I opted for Cape Cod as a single young guy. I don't have any regrets about that choice either. Met my wife there, who was a lieutenant at the time. We got married, had two children, a boy and a girl. And then as time went on, my son had some medical issues that required me to kind of homestead in the Massachusetts area for quite a while. And so I found a bunch of good assignments reoccurring there, to include a 3-year assignment at Boston University. And it was interesting because when I left the Cape, initially, I went to a cavalry squadron. I had to go through a whole bunch of new training requirements to become a cavalry officer. And as I did it in August of 1990, Saddam crossed into Kuwait, and Desert Storm kicked out. Just as I joined, I transferred from the military police to the cavalry. And yeah, I had to become trained as an armor officer instead of a military police officer. And then I went to a cavalry leader program down at Fort Knox. And when the ground war kicked off, I was at becoming certified as a tank commander out in Gowan Field, Idaho, riding around in the desert in Idaho. And they had a big giant screen TV in the tent, when we finished training at the end of the day. And I saw that ground war erupt. And what the 7th Corps did is they did that left hook and blew apart the Iraqi army in 5 days. Pretty amazing stuff. My squadron was supposed to be part of the second rotation in, but there was no second rotation in. We cleaned them up pretty quick. And, I was at about the 20-year mark in my career, and I thought, well, that was that, or the 10-year mark. And I said, we go to war every 20 years. I don't think, that's in the cards for me. And I was trying to figure out new things I'd be working on. And as I continued training, I had an opportunity to go to BU and become an ROTC instructor and assistant professor of military science there. And knock out a master's degree in communications and healthcare marketing. As I left there in the late 90s, I went back and I became an infantry officer. And the brigade I was assigned to was getting ready for some Kosovo deployments. And so from 99 to 2001, that was my focus, was getting units ready for Kosovo and Bosnia. And just prior to 9/11, about 6 months earlier, there was a rapid deployment military police battalion that I was asked to take command of, you know, based on my prior experience. And command's command, you always love those. And I took command of the 211th Military Police Battalion, which is a combat MP battalion. And there's different types of battalions. So a combat MP battalion is basically four separate units. Each one has, basically we have 40-something armored. Back then we had light-skinned Humvees with modern machine guns. So you've got 43 modern machine gun Humvees that go out and do area reconnaissance, zone reconnaissance, convoy escorts, missions like that. And so we were still prepping for that Bosnia mission when 9/11 hit. And that unit was immediately deployed to secure critical sites, to include nuclear power plants, water reservoirs, military installations. And we did that for about 3 weeks after 9/11. Then we received orders to go secure 7 U.S. airports. And so we shifted immediately. And one of the airports we had was Logan Airport, where two of the planes originated on 9/11. And so that was a big deal to us because we were trying to shut down the portal for any type of future activity like that. We had that mission for about 9 months. And my soldiers really, it was a butt kicker to do that one, because long hours, difficult living conditions. But more importantly to them, they were ready to go. And they felt like they were stuck here stateside, because they had this stateside, they call it Operation Noble Eagle mission. I couldn't share with them that I was on classified communications with Army Forces Command fairly regularly, that we were the next battalion in the hopper to head over to Afghanistan. I was still classified. And so we started implementing in-service training while they were at the airport, so that they wouldn't, their perishable skills on their weapons handling, assembly, disassembly of crew served weapons and Mark 19s and their first aid stuff and their chemical bio stuff was all up to speed. We got released from that mission in May 2002, and we received orders for Afghanistan. We reported up to Fort Drum. We had 14 days to certify for overseas deployment, which isn't a lot when you haven't been in it. Our guys did fantastic. And then the battalion was pushed out, and we had units go to Karnish-Khanabad, Uzbekistan, Kandahar, Kabul, Jacobabad, Pakistan, and Bagram Air Force Base. And so we were spread out across the country. And just as the headquarters was pushing out, they came up with a cap on the number of units going, and they split my headquarters, and they let part of it go there, and part of it ran counterterrorist stuff at Drum. Crazy stuff. Pretty disappointing. I was over there for about a month, and I received word that the headquarters was going to be redeployed as soon as it finished that mission as part of the Iraq invasion. And so I left Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan and flew directly to Fort Hood, Texas for a warfighter exercise, which was the pre-deployment training exercise for the 4th Division to come in through Turkey. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with that ill-fated mission, but interestingly enough, we had an entire infantry division's worth of equipment on boats ready to go. And they realized Secretary Paul Wolfowitz came up with the idea, but he never got the Turks to agree to it. And at the last minute, with our division's worth of equipment sitting off the coast of Turkey, they said no. And so we were stuck with my stuff in the water, my folks at Drum. And then the ground war started, and we were kind of sitting on our butts. There was a mishap. And you may have remembered there was a maintenance unit with a young female sergeant that all got captured and taken prisoner. And at that point, they basically said, any unit like mine that was in theater, get them on a plane, get them over there now. And so we had 48 hours notice, wheels up. We were in Kuwait. And as we got ready to go in, my stuff's still sitting on boats steaming towards Kuwait. I remember having a conversation with my boss at the time, who was the assistant corps commander, General Walt Wojciechowski. And by the way, the CG of 5th Corps, not many people appreciate, but movie fans will, was William Wallace. So if you're going to go to war with William Wallace and you feel pretty good about yourself. But General Wojciechowski basically said, you guys have been catching a tan too long out here in the Kuwaiti desert. You need to get into the fight. And I said, you know, sir, my equipment's not here. My vehicles aren't here. And he said, figure it out. And I said, okay. And so we stole a bus, borrowed a bunch of equipment. And I headed into Iraq with my three units. And as we get up to Balad Air Base, which is the center of the Sunni Triangle, I was told that it was a pretty mild, calm area that I just needed to kind of get things under control a little bit. And if anybody remembers some of the stories on the Sunni Triangle, and the new name for Balad ended up being Mortaritaville. We got about 25 rounds of incoming mortar rounds every night. It was a pretty wild place. We were able to secure 10 nautical miles in every direction around the base. It was the logistical hub for Iraq. And once we kind of got a handle on that, within about 30, 60 days, with this kind of ad hoc force, I got orders to split my headquarters, form a second battalion, and proceed to Fallujah. And so I ended up having one battalion in
Hey, Jack, how big was that force that you had that before you had to split it?
It was about three. It was about 500-700, about 500-700 people. And so I split my headquarters, and half my headquarters had to maintain that first battalion. The second one, we formed a new. It was called Task Force Enforcer, and our mission was: they gave me two counterintelligence teams, two PSYOPs teams, and a strike force. And my job was to gather intelligence and conduct direct action missions against the insurgency in Fallujah, and. That was wild. You know, I knew nothing about Fallujah. None of us did. We didn't know anything about Anbar province other than that was west. Nobody thought there was much of a fight out there. And I was supposed to initially go there for 2 weeks. But Anbar province is the worst part of Iraq. It's the worst of 18 provinces. That was a second failure decision made by the leadership at that point. We were supposed to have one last infantry division, the 1st Cav, was supposed to be the last division with the first wave in. And as a cost-cutting measure, they decided to make them not part of the first rotation. They'd be the first division in the second rotation. And Rumsfeld blew that one entirely, because the challenge we had was every province, major province, had a full division plus of about 25,000 soldiers. Out in Anbar, we had a cavalry regiment with about 3,000. And Anbar province was the worst province in Iraq. One third of all U.S. forces killed in action were killed in the Anbar province. And so when we went out there, we just had a skeleton crew. And in Fallujah, we had about 500-600 troops, which there's 300,000 of the worst people in Iraq in that place. And our job was basically to gather intelligence, set up missions, and then conduct raids. And we conduct over 100 different raids. Captured tons of explosives, bomb-making materials, rockets, mortars, machine guns, and a number of high-value targets. Great group of guys. I had this ad hoc force that they cornered around a strike force of a military police unit from the Providence, Rhode Island National Guard. Most of them were cops and DEA agents, which was great. These guys were pretty fearless. They had canvas door Humvees and no body armor, and they were in the worst city in the world, slugging it out every day. Nothing but respect for these guys, and pretty amazing stuff. But that's where I learned all about adapting and innovating and reimagining what's possible, because we had nothing. We had to figure. There was no game plan for anything we've done, and so you just, in the military, you're taught to do a lot of stuff, but the main thing you're taught is to think, mm-hmm. develop intelligence, and then develop a situation, and then take action. If it doesn't work, you adjust, and then you adjust, and you adjust. In peacetime, you're a little hesitant to go beyond your skis much, because there's so many training restrictions, etc. When they take all those things off you, and they basically tell you, you're on your own, figure it out, and do what you think you need to do, it's a life changer. It's a game changer, because you know, if you don't do something, you could get people hurt, and that's the worst thing. So you just figure it out, and if you don't get it right, you get it right the next time. And it's a lot like you were talking about.
You're there building your own business, in a business of life and death business, right? And you said the town of Fujian, how many people? How many citizens there? 300,000, so you say?
300,000, yeah.
And the 500 or 600 troops that do all this work within that. I mean, the worst of that city had to be thinking about ganging up on you guys, right? In any way they could.
Yeah, I mean, you put it in perspective, Saddam never controlled anything west of Baghdad. He had an agreement with it was like in those cities where you kind of build a detente relationship with the mob. You know, if you don't cross these lines, we won't do this. As long as they paid their tribute, their money came in from the west, and they didn't export their stuff from Anbar into Baghdad, he gave them a free hand, and so he couldn't even control them. I mean, if Iraq was going to get an enema, this is where you'd stick the tube.
Wow, man. Yes, so you had to be on your toes every day.
Well, I can tell you, when I had to speak with the mayor of the city of Balad to tell him that I was going to be gone a lot, and I brought in one of my majors and a captain and said, they'll be with you every day. Every 3 or 4 days, I'll be back. You know, I've got to do what I'm doing here in another city. And he said, which one? And I said, Fallujah. Now, I'm at the chief of police of Balad in his office, and he started whispering. That's how he goes, those are very bad people there. You must be very, very careful. And he wouldn't even say it out loud in his own office. And it was like somebody was going to hear, we're going to come get him. That was the first warning for me. My second warning, my mom died when I was there. I had to go home for 4 days for the funeral. When I was home, a family friend from Dubai called. My sister had known him in college. And he asked where I was, and I told him. And he said the same thing. Now, this is a guy who runs businesses in Dubai. And he said, those are the worst people in the Middle East. You'd be very, very careful. And I'm thinking, I didn't get this from my intel briefs. How does a businessman from Dubai, you know, the chief of police in Balad know all this stuff? And how do we miss the cues that this really is the epicenter of the insurgency? In any case, it was a pretty wild place. And every day was an adventure.
And then you had to split that in half, right? And then, did you say Anbar province?
So I had half my headquarters in Anbar, the other half in Balad. I had two separate battalions underneath them, and I'd have to travel between the two of them. And of course, you're dealing with home, and you're trying to explain where you are and downplay everything you're doing so you don't worry the folks at home. I'd say, oh, yeah, I'm going out west. It's nothing on going out there. Next thing you know, it's in the news because of all the things going on in Fallujah. And so my wife said, Jesus, I thought it was quiet. Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? I'm actually not there that much. I'm on the road driving back and forth. Next thing you know, they're talking about roadside bombs. I really could not catch a break on the story, you know, keeping my story straight for home and downplaying what we were doing.
Wow, that's unreal. So this is year, what year is this then, Jack?
That was 2003. So, you know, that command really went from 2001 to 3, doing homeland security stuff, Afghanistan, then Iraq. I came home and they had me working strategic planning and some homeland security stuff. I did a little work with the DNC convention on the military liaison piece. We did Hurricane Katrina. I led a team effort to get down there as a response force. And then I was very fortunate to be selected to go to a one-year national security fellowship at Harvard, which was just a superb experience. I got to build, as an MP, I went through counterterrorism certification training course. I was an instructor. And when I was back in the military police days in the 80s, and then I had the experience of actually hunting terrorists for a living for a year. Then I got to go to Harvard and study it for a year. And I went over to, was able to head over to London and meet with MI5 and MI6, go to Northern Ireland and work with the PSNI. I'd really talked to world leading experts about how they took different approaches. I completed that. I had another assignment as the chief of staff here in Massachusetts for the 8,000 Army and Air National Guard troops that are here. We had two fighter wings, F-15 and an A-10 wing. And then we had an infantry brigade and some support brigades. So that was a pretty interesting experience. And as I wrapped that up, I was able to go to Israel and train with the IDF for about a month. And while there, I received word that I was going to receive a command to go back to Afghanistan in 2010, 11, and 12. And so did my prep work, got ready, spent a short time in 10 at the end of 10. And then from 11 to 12, I was the commanding general for Kabul province. And again, thinking that it's, you know, I was in Kabul in 2002 and it was doing pretty good. I'm coming back there almost, you know, 9 years later, almost 10 years later. And I said, well, this is going to be a lot different than Fallujah. This is just going to, you know, I'm in the capital city. It's a developed theater. You know, they've got internet and restaurants and stuff on the bases. and we had a rough year. The Taliban was trying to demonstrate that Karzai couldn't secure his own city. We had mass casualty producing IEDs regularly around the city. And when I got there, based on my previous experience, I knew that this place was not ready. When I did my pre-deployment recon in late 2010, I found all the major catastrophic failures in security for the capital province. I was able to meet with an amazing guy named General Mike Linnington, who now is the CEO of Wounded Warrior Project. I briefed him on my last night on the recon that, you know, that there were catastrophic failures in place that needed to be addressed on security. The Turkish Brigade was responsible for Kabul province. And interestingly enough, they had been in Turkey, they had been in Afghanistan, 8,000 soldiers, been in Afghanistan for almost a decade, and they had no casualties.
Wow.
So it kind of tells you a lot. You know, the safest place for a ship is a harbor, but that's not why you build ships. And if you stay behind the wire and make deals with the locals and don't engage, you're not doing your job. And so General Petraeus was my senior raider. I got back in the theater and implemented, you know, huge transformation of U.S. I just took over the security from the Turks, didn't ask, didn't tell them. And again, it goes back to when you see something, you do something, as that entrepreneurial spirit. You don't wait for somebody to tell you what you need to do. And it's never the wrong time to do the right thing. I would have felt a lot worse if I didn't take those actions. I had my brigade engineer spend 45 days building me an Operation Intelligence Fusion Center, which is a key to success based on what I learned in my operations in Iraq. You need to have all-source intelligence gathering capability, both human intelligence, which is real-world people, and then data-driven intelligence from all sources to help guide planning and decisions. And so we had three shifts working round the clock to build me that center so I could fuse my intelligence teams and my operations teams with other elements in the city. 1 week after we had that in place, the U.S. Embassy came under attack. There was a mini Tet offensive. ISAF headquarters, NATO ISAF headquarters was under attack. The U.S. Embassy, they blew up a police station I had just left. So there were explosion attacks going all across this city. The U.S. Embassy was under attack for 18 hours. And to this day, I'm mystified when I run into people that didn't know the U.S. Embassy was under attack for 18 hours. And by having that fusion center built and building the response forces, we were able to put down all attacks and then working with the Afghan special operations, take out the bad guys. 3 weeks later, mass suicide casualty attack, 600-pound bomb into the side of one of our buses, killed about 15 of our troops, 5 Afghan kids. So we had to respond to a mass casualty suicide bombing in our city. So that quiet year very quickly became pretty interesting. And again, a lot of things we had to do that we were able to do because I had an incredible group of folks that were innovators and risk takers too. You know, you have to assume some risk. If you don't assume risk, you don't do anything. You know, you never achieve greatness by mediocrity. And yeah. I had the right folks that were focused on, you know, committing to excellence in everything we did. And we had just a phenomenal time there. I got home from that deployment. I had 60 days leave. And on the deck with my wife having a Tangerine tonic, she asked me a question that she'd never asked me before. And we'd been married now 35 years. And she said, so how long you staying? And I said, well, you want me to get out? And she said, that ship sailed a long time ago, but what haven't you done that you want to do? And did you have a reason to stay? And I'd never thought about it. I mean, I was just waiting for new orders. And after I finished the second one, I couldn't think of that assignment that was burning in my gut. And I knew that, you know, I'd had 3 combat commands. I never thought I was going to have any after Desert Storm. I didn't think I was ever going to deploy. And she said, a smart guy might leave before he screws up, which is another great piece of advice. And I had 31 years then. I was pretty tired. I've been deployed a lot. And, you know, as you get older, those deployments, you know, sleeping on the hood of a car at 51 versus 40 was a big difference. And the more I thought about it, I said, you know what? It is a young man's game. And when I leave, there won't be any tears because every colonel behind me looking to become a brigadier general will just quietly thank me. You know, yeah. Oh, it's tough to see you go. Bye. And I dropped my retirement paperwork the next day, and I had no idea what I was going to do. I was going to take some time off and try and figure it out.
What year was this, Jack?
2012. Okay. And I had my eye on a place in Florida. I was going to go sit by the beach and golf for a year, figure out, you know, what I do. And then I got a call from a friend that they said the Red Sox, in his words, the Red Sox were looking for a retired general to lead a program. And interestingly enough, I had visited home base 2 weeks earlier and spoke with the chief operating officer to find out about programs that I could avail my soldiers to, because by 2012, we had seen that suicide rate really skyrocket. I'd seen the impact of a decade of war on guys that were, I call them kids, back in 2001, 2, and 3. You know, they were now mid-career guys. They went from being 18, 19, 20 to mid-30s. The guys that were in their late 20s, early 30s were in their 40s. I saw marriages falling apart. There were 20-year marriages, and I knew folks needed some help. And I found out what home base did. Anyway, long story short was I found out that the Red Sox were looking somebody. They had a search group, Heidrick & Struggles, out of Chicago, trying to find a replacement. 25 admirals and generals were thrown into the mix. I threw my hat in the ring, and at the end of 6 months, I was very fortunate to be asked to take on that role. And again, it was an opportunity to work with some amazing people. And what we've done in the past decade is reimagine what's possible, much like I did in Fallujah, much like I did in Kabul. And the more you do those things, as you know, as a serial entrepreneur, the more you do it, the less afraid you are. The thing is, you know you're going to get there. It's just you got to figure out how to get there. And that's what I had to do at home base.
Yeah, once you're successful, right, when you take risk and you have a vision and you're passionate about that vision, whatever that is, and all those operations, you had to have a vision of what success looked like, and you had to be able to sell that vision to all these soldiers, right? And once you do that and you're successful one time, okay, a little more confidence the next time, and the next time. And you know, within that vision, we know that there's you know, challenges along the way, and there's going to have some failures along the way. And as long as you can lead and lead people to understand that success will happen. And now in business like you are today, I got to believe it's very similar. You know, it's not life and death, but it is life and death. Because if you're doing what you're doing, you're actually changing lives for the better and saving people, hopefully in the long run, making their lives, you know, manageable or even amazing, right? Tell us about this. Tell us about, you know, I'm involved in some philanthropic stuff that I love and I'm very passionate about. Tell us about this whole organization, how it started, what your role is today, the difference you're making in the communities that you're serving.
Sure. So, I would tell you it's an interesting birth of this program. It began while I was in Afghanistan, or just before I went to Afghanistan. The Red Sox, a lot of people don't realize it, like them, hate them, they are the most philanthropic sports franchise in America, bar none, every sport included. And it began with Ted Williams back in the 50s and their support for kids with cancer and the Jimmy Fund. And it's just grown and grown and grown. And so after their game-changing 2003 World Series, they broke the curse. They went to the White House for the meet and greet with the president, and then they went to Walter Reed, and they met the young warriors, the injured warriors, and they were moved very much to the point where they flew a bunch of folks from Walter Reed up to Fenway Park for the ring ceremony when the season began. Flash forward, 2007 World Series, 2008, back to meet the president. They set up a follow-on meeting at Walter Reed again, and at this point, it's the height of the surge in Iraq. We have the most catastrophically injured young men and women there, and picturing the fact that the Red Sox had been there a few years earlier in the early stages of the war, and now they're back, and the place is full with young amputees, burn victims, et cetera, They were really moved. And one guy in particular, Tom Werner, who's the president of the Red Sox, he's one of the primary owners. His dad had been an OSS guy in World War II. He had, you know, supported the Normandy invasion. And I know Tom, you know, noticed the impact of the war on his dad. He never really figured it out till he was a grown man, and he kind of went to Walter Reed a few times and got that. He was moved to action. And so the program began with the Red Sox. They came back to Boston. They met with the president of Mass General, and they asked him to partner with the Red Sox to develop a clinical program for the invisible wounds of war. And Peter Slavin was the president of Mass General, and he was a Harvard grad, Harvard Medical School, Harvard MBA. And my daughter went to that great university, and she said that those guys were a special kind of crazy when they take on, you know, med school and an MBA program at the same time. And Peter's a great guy, and he basically went back to the trustees and said, this is the worst business decision we could possibly make, but it's the right thing. And they voted unanimously to support it. Both entities agreed to contribute $1 million a year for the first 3 years, and then set the conditions for the program to thrive on its own after that. I arrived year four. Now, nobody had told me that the money had run out. and I've got to share this with you, because our operating budget back then was about $3 million. And we got $1 million for the Red Sox, $1 million from Mass General. And we did something called the Run to Home Base, which was a road race that began and ended at Fenway Park. And you got to step on home plate. And that made $2 million. So that's where the money came from. In 2013, my spring of 2013, when I was about 6 months on the job, we had the Boston bombing. And they canceled every activity in the city, which meant our race. And so I said, Wow, at least we have them. So I met with my chief operating officer, and I said, well, at least we've got that money from the Red Sox and Mass General. And he laughed. He goes, no, that ran out. This is the that ran out last year. And so we were looking pretty grim. Fortunately, they caught the bad guys. The mayor opened up, we were the first external event the city allowed to happen. And then we decided, you know, we need to be much more diversified. And it was a great business lesson, because we had all our eggs in one basket, and we almost, you know, got cooked. So since that time, you know, they created one of the best regional-based clinics for post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury. They leverage all the resources from Mass General Hospital, Harvard Medical School, Spalding Rehab, and they're able to just pull amazing clinicians from each of these institutions. And to put it in perspective, MGH has the number one department of psychiatry for the past 30 years. It's either one, two, or three, but it's one of the best, and it's deep, deep, deep resources. And Spalding Rehab is one of the top three rehab hospitals in the country. Its president is a guy named Ross Safant, who leads my brain injury program. And Ross is the chairman of the Department of Rehab Medicine for Harvard Medical School. He is the president of Spalding. He runs the NFL Concussion Clinic in Boston. And he's been at home base one day a week since 2009, overseeing our brain injury care program. And so pretty powerful stuff. Our limiting factor was the fact that it's outpatient care and you got to be commuting distance into Boston. So very quickly, we started designing programs to be able to open the scale and really open access to veterans anywhere. And so we designed a 14-day program with dual track for PTSD and traumatic brain injury. And we were able to compress 2 years of therapy into 14 days. And that's a game changer. If you've ever gone to physical therapy for an injury, you go see the PT once a week for an hour. They give you homework. You come back next week, you lie about doing everything they told you to do. They give you more homework. They work with you a little more, and over 10 or 12 weeks, you get better, right? If you could go get a hotel room outside Gillette Stadium and work with the New England Patriots sports medicine team from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. for 14 days straight, would you get better faster? Acupuncture, massage therapy, hydrotherapy, you know, everything in the world.
That's the best.
So we were able to leverage every modality and type of treatment you could bring to bear on this and get them 2 years of therapy into 14 days by having them going after it from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. for 2 weeks. This has been a game changer. And through this program, we have treated, by the way, this, all costs are covered by us. And so we, since for 7 years now, we've been flying veterans in from all across the country at no cost to them for this program. We've now had several thousand come through it. We've had veterans from all 50 states, and we've flown U.S. veterans in from 13 countries. Again, all at no cost to them, but this game-changing, life-saving care. And we, you know, success builds on success, and you're not afraid to try more big and hard things. And so just prior to COVID, the development group folks from SEAL Team 6 reached out to us and asked us if we could build out our TBI program to accommodate the high significant number of concussive injuries sustained by our special operators. And so we agreed in 2020 to see 15 guys. They sent us 70. And that's the most expensive care you can imagine between MRIs, CAT scan, PET scan, all that stuff. But we have a hard time saying no. And since that time, since 2020, we've had almost 800 special operators sign up for this program, most of them on active duty, on SEAL teams, Delta, SF teams, Ranger battalions, because we're able to leverage the best resources in the country. And it's not that other places don't have some of these amazing resources. You know, that's a pretty haughty attitude to take. But what I'll tell you is, it's great that they're there, but if you can't access them, they're not there. And so no other academic center with the shoulders that Mass General and Harvard has opened up their care like this. And they've given us the keys to the castle. The team, the sports, so when the guys come for this program from the special operations community, they'll get their cognitive testing, their brain injury testing, all their scans done. And this is over 4 days. Then they'll have a complete mental health evaluation, behavioral health evaluation, cognitive functioning. Then they'll go over to the Mass Eye and Ear Institute to check their vision and hearing and all the things that contributed to cognitive function based on those injuries, headaches, all those things. They'll go over to the sports medicine team, the MGH sports medicine, the specific people that treat the Bruins, the Red Sox, and the Patriots. So they deal with elite athletes with concussive injuries in their neck, shoulders, and back. Because if your back is jacked up, your neck is hurt, you don't sleep well. If you don't sleep well, then your behavioral health is jacked up, and then your cognitive processing is screwed up. You know what I mean? So we figured all these things. They'll go to the MGH Sleep Center. At the end of 4 or 5 days, they'll get 10 separate diagnosis and treatment plans, case management on the back end where home is, and we're able to turn things around for these guys because we know that that walkway between traumatic brain injury and suicide is huge. And within the special forces community, special operations community, we had a 300% increase in suicides from 2017 to 2018. They got that organization extremely concerned. So we've had about 800 folks sign up for this program. There's only 70,000 operators in the country from the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. So roughly one out of six of the operations folks have been coming to us. Every fourth person that comes to my intensive program is an operator. And it's pretty wild considering before 2020, none, because they just had that thing where they didn't want to, you know, they played hurt.
So Jack, I've heard the stats before and I don't know them exactly now, but I mean, I'm involved in Navy SEALs Foundation and a couple other ones.
Huge partner of ours, by the way.
Oh, really? Operation Healing Forces also, have you heard of them?
Yep.
Operation Healing Forces, I'm a contributor to that and a partner there also. And so I've heard the stats, and we also hire military, you know, as much as possible because we love hiring military, you know, veterans. And we've had amazing success because of that in our businesses. But either way, I've heard the numbers. When we look at the amount of soldiers that have died at war in the last 30 years or 20 years, whatever you want to use, 20 years, 30, compared to the amount of suicides, people that have died because of the traumatic, you know, brain injury that have caused, you know, the suicides and everything else, what are those numbers at? I'm sure you've commented on it.
Yeah, no, it's since 9/11, it's more than 150,000 have died by suicide veterans. And from the post 9/11 cohort, which is roughly 3 million veterans, we lost roughly 7,000 to Iraq and Afghanistan. We've lost 30,000 of that same group to suicide. And that's if we're, again, there's a lot of contention on whether the VA is properly counting that, because what they don't count is things that come across as a car accident or a motorcycle accident. And I know from talking to our warriors that they will run a car into a pole, they'll run a motorcycle into a pole so that it's not a suicide appearance, so the families get their insurance.
Sure.
They don't want the stigma attached to their death, and so those accidents don't get counted unless it says suicide. In a lot of ways, they're not counted. And there's been a nonprofit group that's been that vehemently questioned the accuracy of the VA's findings over the past few years, because it went from 20 down to 14, and they called baloney. They're saying it's closer to 35, and it could be as much as 45, 55 a day, which is an extraordinary number, considering the fact that all of us are pre-screened for mental health issues when we come in.
Yeah.
We are only 25% or 28% of the American population, military age, meets the minimum requirement to be a private in the United States Army. 72% of Americans don't meet the minimum requirement to enter the military.
Wow.
Which is a scary
that.
Prospect if we ever had a full mobilization and went to war. You had a World War II scenario, draft everybody. You know, I'm guessing we lower the standards, but that's not a great solution.
Yeah.
They're there is there's a good reason for them.
Hey, Jack, what's Ross's last name again, the chairman?
Zafonte, Z-A-F-O-N-T-E.
Is he a doctor?
Yeah, he's a doctor. And he's
a neurologist.
President
or...
of a. No, he's a they call it a, he's a DO, and it's a very specific to the field of rehab medicine, and so as you can imagine, Spalding Rehab, which is an amazing hospital, opened its doors 5 days before the Boston bombing, and 35 of the amputees were sent there for care. They see brain injury, catastrophic brain injuries every day. They see everybody with all the rehab type long-term injuries or really critical injuries that you see. They see the, some of the most injured folks in the country.
Okay. Well, I'd love to get Ross in front of a good friend of mine. I'm down here right now, halfway through my treatments. Okay. I actually have a son that has cerebral palsy. And we adopted him from Russia when he's 2.5 years old. He had fetal alcohol syndrome that caused cerebral palsy. And by the time he was, my wife took him everywhere across the country to try and get him therapy and everything else. And things worked. He improved. But he still, couldn't perform academically very well, struggled with a lot of things emotionally. On an almost daily basis, had an anxiety attack, almost every day. Finally found out about this biotech that was developed in India by an amazing scientist in India. They looked upon as the Thomas Edison of India, basically. He's still there. He's about my age. He's pushing 60 or about 60 years old. Doing amazing things still today, developing technology that the world doesn't even know about. And some in the world has experienced. So I take my son there. And within 10 days, he's a different guy. He goes through 10 days of treatment with another 18 to go. I take him golfing, and my son has this amazing golf swing, 18 years old, but he can't score worth a darn because he has zero patience, gets frustrated, mad at himself with one bad shot, right? And never scored within 20 strokes of me in a golf game. And he beat me that day, 10 days into therapy. So I knew something was going on. That's evil. I mean, a bit of a pull, but 15 days in, I could see he's not having these anxiety attacks at all. He's very patient, kind of a different guy. 28 days of therapy. Since then, he's never had another anxiety attack. He's 22 now, 4 years later. And, excuse me. So over this time, I get to know the whole team, the scientists, as well as the scientists, the neuroscientists that took me there. Actually, a Harvard PhD grad that got his neuroscience degree at MIT, and got to be good friends with him. And he partnered with his scientist to basically focus only on the brain, and wanted to bring this technology to America and get it approved by the FDA. So he ends up with Roberto Trujillo, originally from Mexico. Finds out that he could do a clinic in Mexico, in Monterrey, Mexico, build a clinic. And at that clinic, he could do all the trials to get the FDA approval. And he was focused on two things mostly. He was focused on cerebral palsy, where they saw amazing results and positive results, and Parkinson's disease, where they saw, pretty good results in reducing Parkinson's disease. This is now 3 years since I invested in it. Came, I was one of the seed investors in it. and it came here. They've done thousands of cases now, focused initially on doing all the double blinds and the placebos on those two things, cerebral palsy and Parkinson's disease. But along the way, they found out kind of a layup is concussive injuries. So they've done a bunch of different stuff on concussions now with amazing success. They took they've had three Navy SEALs that were suicidal in the last year now that have been here. They have all three of them have no suicidal tendencies now. They're keeping in touch with them. They're interviewing them. They're doing all the cognitive testing with them, all those things, and they're doing amazingly well. I'm here because I've got scar tissue in my brain from concussions in the past. So I had these little issues where I'd faint a little bit. And I had these little seizures for 20, 30 seconds. Had four of those in 4 years. And finally, a neurologist tells me, Gary, that's you got scar tissue in your brain. The scar tissue in your brain, we believe is causing kind of an epileptic type of fit that you might have once in a great while, right? Probably not going to kill you, but it's, not good for you probably. And it's, they continue, it could get worse, right? So sure enough, Roberto, this organization I invested in, they look at the scans, the MRIs and say, yeah, it's much like PTSD that we see or an NFL player who's having problems in, at your age, very 50, 60 years old, having issues. They've got a very similar looking MRI. And they've not treated any NFLers, but they've been treating soccer players and rugby players from across the globe now with amazing results. So again, we got approval through the it's like the Mexican and South American FDA recently last week. Okay, got approval to expand this across South America and Mexico. And usually within, a short period of time, within months, maybe a year, FDA follows. We've spent a lot, $20 million or more so far in all these double blinds and placebos and everything. But either way, the results we're seeing are incredible. And so again, love to get Roberto in touch with Ross or you, if you want yourself, Jack, we could do that. He's an amazing guy, super passionate. The neurologists in here, they're doing the work. The doctors here, super cautious, right? They're not telling the story of optimism if they're not seeing amazing results. So I'll tell you, during this treatment, so this technology, the crazy scientist in India, an amazing guy, Dr. Kumar, when I was over there, I saw all kinds of things. I saw guys our age, your age, my age, going in with knees that were terrible. Couldn't walk out a knee or two, and leaving within 10 days, walking on the knee. 28 days later, that these guys our age feel their knees like totally repaired, right? So it doesn't. This guy, the scientist in India works out everything, but whether it be cartilage in your knee, it's basically regeneration of cells that have gone bad, right? Whether they're ruined, they're overworked cells and cartilage, or it's your brain cells like the scar tissue as I have or whatever. Anyway, it's an amazing innovation, I think, and it's going to do a lot to help in the world in a big way. I'm excited. It's going to be about an investor in it, and I'm a guinea pig right now, and we'll see how it goes. But I feel good. But one other thing, for the heck of it, he MRI'd my knee, and he goes, any other problems you got, Gary? We'll play around. You're a guinea pig. You're an investor. I said, you know what? I got a bad knee. It's been bad. I ran for governor in my state of Illinois, Jack, and I'm a little bit a little competitive. So the other governors' candidates, they walked down the parade route in the middle of the route. I sprinted down both sides of the parade route, shaking hands and touching everybody I could. And I had a Blues Brother car. A friend of mine has a Blues Brother car, like the original, and he had music playing. He says, use the hood if you want to. So I jump up on the hood. I'm dancing on the hood, jumping off the hood. The parade route goes nuts. They have fun with it, right? So I was doing this all the time until. Like the last time, I wiped out. I jumped up on the hood. I'm dancing. I jump off the hood. I wipe out. I mess up my knee, and it hadn't been the same in the last 8 months since then. So for that comment, I said, my knee's been bothering me ever since I jumped off that Blues Brother car, and so I said, if you want to play with that, that's great. Well, it's been 15 days right now, and I'm telling you, my knee is 90% now, and it was probably 50% then, and it's 90% now. And to the touch, I feel like almost no pain. And so again, I didn't expect that as something I would get fixed here either. But either way, that when you can degenerate, or they can actually degenerate cells as well, single cells. But in my case, they're concentrated on regenerating cells that are damaged, and it's amazing what it does. So if there's a way we can get together and get them in front of you guys, and you want to send some people our way, or we think within 1 year we'll be in major cities in the country, starting in D.C., Dallas, Chicago, Boston would be a great place. We'll have clinics, we think, within a year to year and a half, and so it's pretty exciting because it's a non-invasive, 1 hour every day for 28 days. It's pretty cool. I mean, the results are amazing, and we're having fun with it. So there's not much stuff that works on the brain, as you know. And this does, and this could be a big difference maker. So excited about it. And like I said, I'm to partner with you guys any way we can in the future on that. So, and again, I wasn't part of the plan here. Didn't know that this connection would be there. So it's pretty cool.
No, but I'd love to learn more about it. And I would share with you two quick anecdotes. And the first was from the chief of psychiatry at Mass General when I first got there. And I was talking about what we were up against and the challenge. And he explained that when it comes to mental health and brain injury, as a nation, we're operating at an AM radio level of medicine in a digital medical world. And when you look at all of the advancements in cancer treatments, where they have, all these miraculous treatments, right? The CRISPRs and all that stuff, we're still using 1950s technology in mental health and brain injury. And so I think at home base, we've got to FM by really leveraging all these resources, but we're still only at FM. President Bush, at a leadership seminar that I spoke at a couple of years ago at the Bush Library, he came in as the final wrap-up speaker, and he was sharing with all these guys that were CEOs from biotech and pharma, and he was explaining to them that the future is wide open for entrepreneurs because nothing's been done. And the challenge is, mental health is the worst reimbursed area of medicine. However, we're seeing the effects of that post-pandemic with just, every major company in the world now is talking about resilience and trying to, try and take care of their people, because you've got the mass quitting, the mass resignation stuff going on. You've got people that are just burnt out and tired. And then you've got the whole change to the workspace between virtual, hybrid, coming into work. And so all of these things with the potential threat of nuclear war erupting from the Ukraine, cascading out here, to the pandemic never seems to go away, and all these things, we've got people with so many mental health challenges, but the chickens have come home to roost because we haven't made the investments in those areas. And so the market is wide open to solutions, because we're looking at, a lot of 1950s technology, medicines, and treatments that are so far outdated that the world is your oyster when it comes to coming up with new treatments, especially when you come to neuromuscular issues, tissue regeneration. There's so many areas that, anyway, so this sounds like an amazing thing, and I personally want to learn more about it. And I can make the introductions to our team as well. Just they're pretty open-minded. It goes to a lot of academic rigor and all that, but they're not snooty about that stuff. They know that good enough's never good enough.
If you ever want to fly down, I've never been to this town in Monterrey, Mexico in my life. Okay, it's the size of Chicago. It's in a beautiful setting in the middle of the mountain, a bunch of mountains. It's unbelievably beautiful, clean. It's a very clean city, very safe city. Not what I expected. I just expected it to be a city in Mexico, no problem, I'll go and all that. Well, again, it's a really nice place, so it makes it easy to hang out here for 30 days. It's very inexpensive to live. But if you ever want to come down here, bring Ross down here. We really believe that targeting the NFL, I was on the NFL Players Association board for about 4 or 5 years. And so I saw the challenges that they were having with concussions there. And, I know there's a big need there as well. And again, you and Ross want to fly down here, I guarantee you, you'll see something here that's just second to none. And a super passionate CEO founder here that that really is just wants to serve, like you or I. We realize that we do great things to make an impact in this world by serving. We'll be fine financially. All things will work out, right? Well, this is an example of that. This guy just all he wanted to do was cure the incurable brain injuries. And that, since he was like 11 years old, as a little boy in Mexico, he was reading books on injuries, brain injury, and all the things we're talking about. Really weird, really crazy story. He's actually on my podcast. His story, I think, is number 24. But incredible story of a guy who grew up in a really poor community, and as a very young man, and all he wanted to do was cure the incurable. And he believed that the brain problems of the brain, as a young man, he saw was the most incurable. And so, sure enough, by the time he graduated Harvard, at a young age, he got into Harvard early, on a scholarship. They wanted him to be a professor there, and he thought it'd be really cool. But then he thought about it and said, I'm not going to be able to cure the incurable. That's something I've been thinking all my life. If I stay as a professor, I really need to go on and be a scientist and really, be in the world of solving the problems. And so sure enough, he had his neuroscience degree. Amazing story anyway. And he's doing cool things that I think are going to make a big impact in the world. And if you partner with him, I'm pretty confident that some of the problems you can't solve, they'll be able to.
Appreciate it. Any information you can send me on that after
this. We'll do that after this. Okay, so hey, we got Joey on the line. Joey likes to ask some questions here as a young entrepreneur and a young leader, wants to be a leader in his life. Joey, fire away with some questions. And then Chris at the end here will just come in at the end and kind of make notes of the laws of success that he saw, things that he saw that created leadership success in you that anybody could learn from. Okay, so Joey, what do you got for questions there, buddy?
Hi, Jack. I just wanted to say thank you so very much for your continuous service to our country, taking care of the veterans, and your 31 years of active duty. People like you enabled someone like me, who was adopted from a foreign country that was highly poor and I don't know what the right word to say, but basically you gave us opportunity to be, people like you has given us opportunities to come to America and have the freedoms to learn and grow and be an entrepreneur like myself. I just had a question. What was the greatest fear during your career that you had to overcome?
I got to tell you, that's the first time I've been asked that particular question. That's a great question. I think for me personally, there's a little bit of a fear of failure always that's present. And that's a good thing, because that drives you to make sure you don't. And so that's always under the current when you jump into the deep end is, did I get myself in over my head? At the height of COVID, I got a call from the governor of Massachusetts, and he said, and this was March 2020, and he said, hey, I need you to do something for me. And I said, what's that? He goes, I need to build a COVID field hospital in Boston. And I said, okay. I said, I'm in. And, someone needs help, I'm in. And so I said, great. I said, where's the money going to come to build this hospital and run it? And he said, we don't know. And I said, but we got to build one. And that's going to cost a lot of money. He goes, yeah, we don't know. And I said, well, who's going to build it? And he said, we haven't figured that out yet. And I said, where are the people going to come from? And he said, I can't tell you where they're going to come from, but I can tell you where they're not going to come from is the area hospitals, because they need everybody they got. And I said, okay. And I said, when do you need this thing up? And he said, 10 days. That was one of the few times I sat down at the end of that call and said, crap, what did I just do? And the long story short was, we figured it out. And I brought together a team of leaders, brought them on first. And then we came up with ideas. We worked on the collective intellect of that group to figure out the problem. So it's not one guy trying to figure out. Now it's a group of smart people. We found the right construction company. We eventually found the source of money. And we built a 1,000-room hospital in 7 days. And we were operational within 10. We hired 1,000 people. And we did it about as creative as you can. I think my biggest fear, though, is that I'm going to let the people down I'm supposed to be helping. Do you know what I mean? That's probably my biggest fear. It's not failure because I know I'll get there, but if I don't get it done right, and I didn't meet the need, like for the governor, he was counting on me to get it done, and it was letting him down. It wasn't so much we wouldn't get there. Would I get there in 10 days? I didn't know. But I think for a lot of people that do this type of work, it's the fear of letting down your team, letting down the people that are counting on you. In your case, Gary, I'm sure it's your investors that put their faith in you. It's more of that than, because there's all sorts of things that can derail you. It doesn't mean you're not going to get there, but if you can't get there in time, sometimes the window of opportunity will close and, it's beyond your control then.
Great points.
And then one other question, who are your mentors that you had that somewhat like molded and helped you figure out your core values that helped you go about your journey for your career?
So I'm one of those guys that's been extremely fortunate to meet some amazing people from different walks of life. I kind of shared a story on an old track coach, and I never really processed it back then, and over time I figured it out. I had the opportunity to spend a long weekend as an aide to a Medal of Honor recipient by the name of Roy Benavidez. And if you've never heard Roy's story, it's one of these stories that is just nothing short of remarkable. He was half Yaqui Indian, half Mexican. He was a migrant. He was an orphan. His uncle brought him up here and helped raise him. And by his own admission, he was a punk until he joined the military. And giving you the Reader's Digest version, he left Vietnam from his first tour as a paraplegic because he had a mine detonate, corkscrew hit him in the rear end hip, could not walk. They were trying to teach him to drive a wheelchair, and he refused to quit. Every night they'd find, the morning they'd come back, they'd find him on the floor because he was reteaching himself to walk because they didn't think he could do it, and he knew he would. Within 2 years, he was back in Vietnam. He had gone back on jump status. He had gone through special forces training, and he was a Green Beret, and he was wounded 19 times in one battle, saving a group of people. He came home as a paraplegic and within two years, I learned so many lessons about never quitting, never giving up. A lot of patriotic values from Roy that carried over. And then all the different captains and sergeants major I worked with on that side. In business, when I've come back, obviously my friends from the Red Sox, Tom Werner. But there's a guy, Jack Connors, who is one of my personal mentors. He created an ad agency back in the late 60s. And he says he's one of the original Mad Men. And Jack's buy-in to this company that is called Hill Holliday. Now, it's one of the big firms on the East Coast. It was originally Hill Holliday, Connors, and Cosmopolis. The buy-in was $1,500, and he was short a grand. And so, like most startups, he didn't take a salary, so he had to drive a cab and sell beer at night to pay off $1,000 and take care of his family. When I met with him, his retirement office was the top floor of the Prudential building in Boston, or the Hancock building in Boston. Tallest building in Boston, he had the top floor. And Jack shared with me that I still carry on to this day, is number one, there's no shortage of money, there's a shortage of good ideas. If you can come up with the good ideas, we'll find the money will find you. The other valuable lesson he taught me, because I've always believed in the fact that you got to commit to excellence, not perfection. Anybody that's committing to perfection, I think they need to go see a therapist maybe and work on that issue, because there's no such thing as perfection. The world changes, everything shifts. So you get closer, then the goalposts move again on you. So if you focus on excellence versus perfection, you're going to find it, but you got to be willing to make mistakes. And the lesson Jack taught me on mistakes was, and I've abbreviated a little bit, but mistakes are the tuition you pay for success. And you've got to accept mistakes as part of the risk. With no risk, there's no reward. But with no risk, there's also no mistakes. And so many people choose a path of mediocrity and safety, but they never achieve anything because they never risk anything. But that's my favorite is, the tuition is mistakes are the tuition you pay for success.
I love it. Those are great. Those are great ones. Well, I'll tell you what, I really appreciate it. Chris, what did you find in this podcast, this episode that that hit you.
Yeah, no, that was great. Thank you so much for your time, Jack. You're an inspiration. I love your work with veterans. It's awesome, man. I'm honored to have met you. I got to spend this time with you. Any success you have will oftentimes be based on amazing mentorship. You mentioned some incredible mentors that you had in your life. Like, what? Wow, like those stories were incredible. In the military, the main thing you are taught is to think. You never achieve greatness through mediocrity. The safest place for a boat is in the harbor, but that's not what it's made for. If you put your mind and creativity to work, you can build a 1,000-room hospital staffed by 1,000 people that is operational in 10 days. It's incredible. There's no shortage of money, just a shortage of good ideas. I think everyone could benefit from hearing that. Commit to excellence, not perfection. And mistakes are the tuition you pay for success. That's brilliant. I want that on my tombstone.
Well, I appreciate that. Again, it comes from a lot of smart people and good friends that support you over the years, and you learn. And you know what I mean? I think one lesson that a lot of folks, and we always talk about it, a lot of people will say, I coulda, woulda, shoulda. You know, I coulda done this, I shoulda done this, I woulda done that. But they just didn't have that confidence to step through the looking glass like Alice and into that unknown. And if you can summon the internal courage to step through the looking glass into the unknown, that's half the battle. And once you've done it, and Gary, I'm sure with all the businesses you've started, first one's scary, second one's a little scary, and it gets less and less, but you have that optimism that you know you're going to succeed no matter what. If you got to know it inside and believe it, if you know you're going to succeed, you're not as afraid to step through that looking glass. You'll have that moment of concern like I did getting off the phone with the governor, but you know, it took a minute to shake it off and said, we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out. There's always a way.
Well, then, and Jack, you know what? What we've been blessed with every day we try to live, get out of life and do the right thing. It's amazing that the network of people that around you that trust you, right? That become your friends, that trust you, that you trust. And when you had that challenge with that obstacle, I know exactly what you did. I mean, you just went to your friends. You went to all these friends, and you said, okay, who understands how to build take bats? Who's the best person to recruit? Maybe retired nurses and doctors. And you went to your network and your mind and the smartest people in the space that you knew that would have the talent to for that solution. And again, how blessed are you and I and any of us that live lives like we have that you can actually do that, right? I've had a bunch of experiences in my life where I just jumped into things and I'll figure it out. We'll figure it out somehow. And I put together a forum of mine, a brain trust of forums of mine that people I love that I trust that'll go through a wall for me and I'll go through a wall through them. I start with that. And then with that 5, 10, 15 person, brain trust or whatever, then come up with the solutions and then reach out further to other minds that they know and trust. And you get things done, right? If it's sincerely to solve the problem, And none of the minds are there saying, what's in it for me, right? You're doing that because there's something there for Jack. You're doing it 100% because you knew that if you could do this, man, you can make a difference and make impact in people's lives. So that's really cool. And yeah, I think that's something that I take away from this is through the military, through the respect you've gained in the business community, in this great community of Boston of philanthropic mind, right? I mean, you've got a list of people that can solve problems the rest of your life, and that's the exciting thing, right? When you know you can do that with the friends that you surround yourself with. So, and I love life nowadays more than I ever have because I've got this this equity, right? This equity in friends that I love that I know will do whatever it takes to help me in any way, and I'll do anything it takes to help them. and this for the future. I want to be able to contact you after this because again, I think there's a good chance that the solution I'm in the middle of right now could be another one in your arsenal to solve the problems you're going to be solving the rest of your life.
No, I look forward to it. I really do. And it was really great meeting you guys today. It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Well, thank you so much, Jack. I really appreciate your time, and we've been blessed to have you on board. Hey, do you know General Flynn at all? Do you ever do anything with Flynn when you're in the?
Not directly. Yeah, we've crossed in different paths, but I know obviously who he is.
Yeah, we're with him on some stuff too right now. Philanthropic stuff also. He's like you. He just wants to serve the rest of his life. And when you've got somebody that's been through what you have and he has, and that they want to serve, right? Not go retire on the golf course. Not that I don't like golf, and you probably do too. But you know what? He wants to serve the rest of his life and do great things. And when you see people like you and him, I mean, I'll tell you, I want to be on their team to solve problems the rest of my life. So thanks for all you do. Really appreciate you, Jack. God bless you. And thanks a lot. And we'll follow up on this other subject afterwards. But thanks to thanks everybody for listening today. Until next time, I'm Gary Rabot at Ditch Digger CEO. Thank you, guys.
If you enjoy this show, please share with anyone else you think will find value here. And please go to our website, ditchdiggerceo.com, for show notes, links, video clips, and more nuggets of entrepreneurial wisdom. Don't forget to follow me on social media at ditchdiggerceo.
Cans, paper routes, mowing lawns, careless hands. Daddy had 6 kids to raise. Factory and not a neighbor. My day. Learn by example, not the words you say. Hard work is earned.